And 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center, and always on the Civic Media app.
ABC News. I'm Daria Albinger. President Biden says the U.S. will be with Ukraine until they win the war against Russia. He and President Zelensky today signed a bilateral security agreement on the sidelines of the G7.
The agreement that President Zelensky and I just signed also lays out our shared vision for a just peace, a peace rooted in the U.N. Charter and the principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity.
G7 members also agreed to fund a $50 billion loan to Ukraine with profits from frozen Russian assets. Former President Trump made a rare appearance in Washington to lay out his second term agenda for Republican lawmakers. They included Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who he hadn't spoken to since 2021. The Senate failed to advance a package of bills that would protect IVF access nationwide. Republicans Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins joined Democrats in the 48-47 vote. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Another two-year college is closing in Wisconsin. The University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh is closing its Fox Cities campus a year from now. Enrollment has dropped by nearly two-thirds over the past decade. UW System Schools have closed four other two-year branch campuses since last year. The First Lady of the United States, Jill Biden, visited Green Bay Thursday, launching the Seniors for Biden-Harris campaign. Democrats are courting elderly voters by highlighting the contrast between their administration and former President Donald Trump's stance on issues important to seniors. Jill Biden says age is not the issue in this election.
But what this election is about, it's about the character of the person leading our country. It's about finishing the job we started.
Polls are showing Biden and Trump are neck and neck in popularity among Wisconsin voters. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on News from the Center. 107.7 FM and 1450 AM WRCE and on the Civic Media app. Max Inc. Radio.
He can play it all, and we'll challenge Graham Marlowe to it when he's in studio for a live Saturday night concert. I'm Terry Barr. Join me, Rocker, and Jimmy Kane.
Weekend evenings on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Woke up this morning, got a message from a listener going, hey, did you see this? Chris Kobach, you know, from the Kobach Commission during the Trump years to do cross-check across the country to throw people off the voting rolls. You know, Chris Kobach, the voter suppression guy. Well, he's Attorney General of Kansas, and he's got a new crusade. You know, going after immigrants and going after unions. Yeah. In fact, Chris Kobach, very angry at the Department of Labor. They have come out with a new rule, a final rule that he has taken exception with. He says this rule is not just a violation of the law, it is bad policy. Chris Kobach goes on to say, once again, the Biden administration has placed the interest of foreign nationals over the interests of United States citizens. He says giving unionization protections to a class of employees naturally drives up the cost of doing business for employers. So again, going after the immigrants, going after unions, because why would we want them to make decent wages? Now, he's not alone. Chris Kobach, not alone. You got 22 Republican attorneys general who have signed on to fight the U.S. Department of Labor on this new rule, which... What the new rule does It allows agricultural workers who are here on H-2A temporary work visas to have concerted activity to make their workplace safer. Concerted effort to ensure that they don't get cheated out of wages. Basic wages, hours, conditions kind of stuff. Workplace protection, that gives them the ability without fear of retribution or punishment or beatings. Gives them a little bit of a foot to stand on. Now, what's interesting is you've got these attorneys generals, and you know the states, Kansas, Georgia, South Carolina, Arkansas, Florida, Idaho. You can join in Indiana, Iowa, Louisiana, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, and others. More, I'm sure, will come. More red states who want to go after those immigrants. And, of course, those unions. Because, look, right now, the Republican Party is all about, going after the immigrants and the workers. It's that simple. And what I find interesting is I read a good portion of the law that this final ruling that they've come out with. Now, understand, Republicans are very clear in wanting to make sure that workers are exploitable. So the idea of collective action, they hear collective, their mind just explodes. They hear concerted activities, mind explodes. Now, Kobach is accusing this administration of giving foreign farm workers something that American farm workers can't have because our laws are so badly broken that American farm workers, under federal law, bans American farm workers from collective bargaining. It's what happened, all those years ago, and we've never fixed that. So instead of saying, hey, maybe we fix that, no, Chris Kobach says, no, nobody gets nobody. Now, what I find interesting is they're going after, Joe Biden's putting America last. This is a great talking point. It's great for talk radio. They're going to give these immigrants rights. How dare they? But if you actually read the final rule, and again, I did, it's very clear. And I quote, the final rule does not require H-2A employers to recognize labor organizations or to engage in any collective bargaining activities, such as those that may be required by the NLRA itself or by state law, such as California Agricultural Labor Relations Act. It is specific, written right in the final rule. This does not give them collective bargaining rights. It gives them the ability to have concerted activity without fear of retribution or reprisal. Very different. This is saying that you can band together for mutual protection to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. Like any association, you look at the trucking association, they've got their thing, the owner-operators association. There are all of these groups out there that they have some level of protection in numbers. What this is doing is saying, look, these foreign workers who are here as guest workers, they've gone through the process. They got the H-2A visa. They're here working. We should give them some level of protection. Now, why did I bring this up today? Because I thought it was quite ironic that when I got this message, within an hour, I got an email from the U.S. Department of Labor that points out that they had gone after a Nebraska construction company operating in Southern California and blatantly, as they put it, blatantly and willfully discriminating against U.S. workers by bringing Mexican workers into the U.S. under false pretenses, shortchanging their wages, and putting their safety and health at risk and in substandard living conditions. What they were doing is they were bringing people in saying, these are farm workers. They brought them in under these H-2A agricultural visa program. They brought them in to do farming. And what did the operators of R&R Cristo Construction LLC of Fremont do? Well, they put them to work in construction. Now, the Department of Labor forced them to pay, you know, wages of almost $300,000 in back wages to these workers, and you know, almost $64,000 in penalties. And look, you know, again, slap on the wrist. It just is what it is. These companies keep getting away with this. You don't see R&R Christo Construction going to jail. But I found it interesting that here you have this situation where they're right in the report. This company abused this program, deliberately misrepresented the fact that these foreign workers were coming here to do agricultural work when in fact they were, as the Department of Labor says, they were employed for construction jobs at a San Joaquin poultry operation. The judge accordingly found the employer profited by abusing and exploiting vulnerable, unsuspecting H-2A workers by misrepresenting the nature of the job. The employers discriminated against U.S. construction workers and discriminated against workers here and failed to meet their legal obligation by employing agricultural workers. You read a little bit further down and you found out that the division learned of the situation after a referral prompted by Cal OSHA, which had investigated injuries suffered by these H-2A workers after falling from a roof. Again, you have one thing happen, and then a bunch of people start looking. They got cheated out of overtime. They got cheated out of wages. The housing was deplorable. In fact, they said that they had like 11 cots in one room. And you go, why do guest workers need some level of protection? R&R Christo Construction kind of rings a bell. And as they point out, look, the reality is, under California law, employers must pay construction workers 8 hours after working 8 hours a day and 40 in a work week. Employers can't pay H-2A workers less than what's required under the law. And yet here they were, surprise, 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 here they were cheating these workers out of wages. And what were they doing? They were lining their pockets. And this isn't new. This stuff happens in a lot of places. It happened, you know, here in Pennsylvania years ago, where you had, you know, people here on visas who were supposed to be, you know, student work visas, you know, working, you know, 100 hours a week at a fast food joint, living in a house, 15 people to a basement, while this company was making huge money, not paying them overtime, and in a lot of cases, not even paying them minimum wage. And I argued at the time, you know, they were here on a visa to experience America. And I said, you know, they got an experience, all right. They now know what it's like to be a low-waged worker in this country. They now know what it's like to be left behind by labor law. But I found it ironic that, you know, someone would send me this story, like, can you believe this? And look what they're doing. And then this story pops up. Now, am I surprised that Republicans are okay with exploitation like this? No, I'm not. And you shouldn't be either. But it is angering. And if there are problems like this in our labor law that farm workers can't unionize, maybe we fix it. Maybe we go and we fix the law to help make lives better. I don't know. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Michael Sonato, reporter over at The Guardian, is going to come share some thoughts on some big labor stories. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So an interesting story coming out of California. About 6,000 grocery workers at the Kroger-owned Food for Less. As we speak, they're voting on whether or not to strike. Their contract ended on Saturday. It expired. They haven't gotten a new contract. And they're saying, look, you know, going to have to put that strike arrow in the quiver. And here to share some thoughts on, well, you know, what this could look like, what it means, and why we're here, I've asked Michael Sonato to come talk with us. Michael's a labor reporter over at The Guardian U.S. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again, Rick.
So I look at this 6,000 grocery workers said, you know what, wages aren't good enough, benefits aren't good enough, we demand better. I'm not surprised, you know, given the last couple of months, but what's going on?
Basically, this Kroger-owned chain, Food for Less, these workers have, toiled through, they've got this company through the pandemic. Their stores in Southern California are, you know, some of the top revenue producing grocery stores in the area, but their wages lag pretty far behind other grocery stores in the areas, the average being, you know, over $4 an hour. Difference between a grocery clerk at Food for Less and a grocery clerk at Ralph's, and some of the benefits, their guaranteed hours are worse also, and they're just asking to be brought up in line with the rest of the, you know, the chains in the area at Kroger, and these grocery workers have been, you know, fighting Kroger for the past few years. They were criticizing the company. They got rid of hazard pay during the pandemic. Kroger shut down stores in response to local areas of California enacting that $5 hazard pay for grocery workers because, you know, of everything they were put through during the pandemic. And they're still reeling from those issues. So, you know, these workers are putting their foot down. Kroger, multi-billion-dollar company. Workers have been on strike in different areas in the country, at this grocery chain. And, you know, for the past year and a half, they've, been trying to push through another merger, trying to acquire the Albertsons chain. Workers with UFCW have been, you know, sounding the alarm saying, you know, they've done mergers like this. And what happens is jobs get lost, or, you know, if worker, even one of the workers I brought back, they worked for a grocery chain 30 years ago. They got laid off and got called back at the same grocery store, different brand name. Their wage got cut by like $7 an hour. They lose their seniority. So they've been fighting all these different things, and this is just, you know, the next chapter in that story of workers, you know, taking on this company.
No, they've seen this movie, and it doesn't end well for the workers. It does well, I'm sure, for the corporate CEOs and the executives and the shareholders, not so much for the workers. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, it's Food for Less. It sounds like it's Work for Less. That sounds what it is. And I guess as we speak, as you've reported, they're already looking for scabs to come replace these workers in the event of a strike.
Yeah, they've had signs posted up in stores, open interviews, looking for replacement workers in the event of a strike, which just goes to show you, where they were thinking. And that was a couple of weeks ago before the contract even expired. So, they're ready. But these workers are ready to go out if need be. The results are set to be out probably late Friday night, given, you know, they're over in the West Coast, possibly right. Saturday. I'm not sure how early the strike will be called, but We'll see if the strike vote gets the company to make any movement. Right now, they're pretty far apart on wages. They're, you know, asking for that over $4 an hour increase, and the last best final offer from the company was, you know, a little over $3 over 3 years, so like a dollar. So it's pretty significant. So we'll see where that happens.
Yeah, what's interesting to me though, you know, the fact that they are advertising for scabs to come and replace these workers, is we know in these situations that these companies are willing to spend enormous sums of money to get scabs to cross the picket line. We know that they're willing to spend, you know, millions and millions of dollars to get these scabs to force a bad contract on workers, but yet they won't spend that same money to make their workers happy. It's really twisted. And, you know, just yesterday we were talking about IKEA. And IKEA, you know, a couple years ago had a people were leaving. And they said, hey, what can we do to keep people from leaving? We want them to stay. So what'd they do? They raised wages. They got better working conditions. They got better benefits. They did the things that, you know, make people want to stay.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately the modus operandi of corporations in this country. They'd rather spend, you know, more money fighting their workers, fighting unions, than, you know, what would it take to, you know, give them a fair contract.
It's again, it boggles the mind, but because I don't believe it's about the money. I think it's purely about the control. It's about the we don't want to, and we're not going to give in to you. So we'll see on Friday what happens here. I got to get some thoughts on your other story that caught my attention over at John Deere. John Deere won a good contract for their workers, decent wage increases, decent benefits, a company that's wildly profitable. And now we see that they're laying people off. They're firing people, moving jobs to Mexico. Is that true?
Absolutely. They've announced, you know, 650 official layoffs, and just in the Iowa plants so far this year, over 100 workers taking early retirement. There's been some layoffs at the Illinois plants, and they announced the very end of May that they plan on, you know, enacting more layoffs. They didn't give a number, but, you know, they're anticipated that those layoffs are going to happen sometime in August. They did announce in 2022 that they plan to phase out some lines and move production to Mexico by the end of this year. And they are opening another plant in Mexico, which is expected to be open in 2026. And they're moving that production from the U.S. to Mexico. And like you said, there's no reason for that. This company's making money hand over fist. They're spending a lot of money on stock buybacks. It is a cyclical business. They've been known to enact layoffs, but at this scale, it's pretty, unheard of. And it's going to be interesting to see kind of how the opposition to these comes out. The Biden administration, it hasn't gotten into the political realm. It really hasn't been, up on that radar. The UAW, the national union, hasn't said anything. One of the local presidents, criticized John Deere for outsourcing for these layoffs. From my understanding, they're, you know, in talks to see what they can do to at least mitigate what's going to happen. But it's going to be something to keep an eye on. Because I think it could have big political ramifications if a company like John Deere is, you know, outsourcing hundreds of jobs to Mexico a few months before the election.
No, especially in places like Iowa and other states where John Deere is big in. You know, we were in Ottumwa, Iowa during our Working Class Heroes tour, and the John Deere plant, that was the job in the area. The fact that, you know, you could possibly lose more jobs in that area. A lot of the small towns we went to on our tour, you saw the kind of hollowing out that I would expect if John Deere were to leave. So this isn't good news, but this should be a bipartisan, nonpartisan political issue, because you got Trump who was saying, hey, we got to keep manufacturing here. You got Biden who's trying to reshore manufacturing. This should be something that would unite the country against John Deere on all sides of the political spectrum, don't you think?
Yeah. And, you know, John Deere makes a lot of money off of federal contracts. So it's not like there's nothing that politically can be done. On top of the fact of the matter is they're moving production to Mexico, but they're sending that product back into the USA. You know, this is their main market. This is where they're making money. So, you know, the only reason to do this is to exploit the cheap labor costs, you know, in Mexico. And there are, you know, political avenues, whether it's, you know, tariffs or, you know, leveraging federal contracts to get John Deere to at least, you know, back off on, you know, some of their plans.
Now, you mentioned that the company, you know, wildly profitable. And in fact, in your reporting, you said in 2023, they made $10 billion, over $10 billion in profit. They paid their CEO $26.7 million in compensation. They spent $7.2 billion on stock buybacks. So they're not hurting. So the other question that comes out of this, since they're not hurting, it's not about the money. It seems like to me, and maybe you've got a thought, and maybe in talking to these workers, maybe they had a thought, that this seems like retribution for what happened during the strike and the fact that John Deere had to cough up a little bit more money than they thought they should have to.
You know, there were some concerns, too, that, you know, this could be, you know, scaring workers ahead of the next contract fight in 2027. You know, because with that Mexico plant planning to open in 2026, there's, you know, if they're moving production from U.S. to that plant, there's going to wind up being more layoffs. So that's certainly a concern from workers that I've spoken with.
Is there anything, you know, in talking with some of the leadership, is there anything that can be done, do you think? Clearly, it's going to be a political football issue, but is there anything that can be done? I mean, you know, this company is going to move production to Mexico, and as you said, they're going to bring those products right back here, like it was made here, and you know, and try and pawn it off as such. Is there anything that they're saying? Hey, we need to get this done. Biden needs to do this. Is there anything yet concrete of a path to stop this?
You know, unfortunately, I haven't seen anything. And, you know, after my article went up, I saw on Reddit's John Deere site, there was, you know, someone purporting to be a worker talking about how management is treating these layoffs. That, you know, they explained, you know, we've seen layoffs before, but something is different. Something, you know, the attitude from management, the kind of that, you know, just disrespect is kind of something they haven't seen before. And that's concerning, you know, concerning that workers are getting that sense, and concerning that there have been significant layoffs already. And, you know, there could be more. You know, they said there are going to be more. It remains to be seen. You know, John Deere did not give me any information. They did not want to respond to my questions about what's going on. And from what I've seen the past weeks since my story came out, they've been mum about it. So, you know, another frustrating thing is 2022, the trade adjustment petition, which provided workers impacted by offshoring, that lapsed.
Yeah.
So now, you know, the transparency, you know, we lose a sense of transparency with that. And these workers, they lose, you know, I think there was a U.S. senator that kind of pointed out there's a big discrepancy between workers who get this trade assistance and workers who don't in terms of their income afterwards. So, you know, that's going to have a big impact with the fact that, you know, they don't have any resources or support anymore. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, the people who got trade adjustment assistance in the past, and I've known a number of people who've had to use this, unfortunately. Generally, you get like 2 years of unemployment as long as you're going through like a training program, and they help you get into a training program, either through a community college or some type of trade school or something, to help you find that next job. There's actually a path to help you get skills and training to get the next job. And there is a little bit, there's more unemployment and some other things that come along with that. So when that goes away, and as you said, you know, Thanks, Republicans, and some Democrats too, but mostly the Republicans ended this. And, you know, now these people are going to be screwed, because I guess the argument now is, well, it's not trade. We're just leaving. We're abandoning the workers in the country. I guess that's the argument as opposed to a trade argument. No.
You know, I guess so. Yeah.
Because I can't come up with another one.
No. I got nothing for you either.
It's amazing stuff to me, but I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on this, and I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on what's going on here. But it's angering, absolutely just angering. Michael, I appreciate the time as always. Great having you on the program. Thanks so much.
Of course. Anytime, Rick.
Michael Sinatto, labor reporter over at The Guardian. Make sure you check out his work over there at The Guardian. Great stuff. We'll get some links out on social media. You can check the latest pieces. Want to hear your thoughts. Do you think it's retribution? Or do you just think it's just pure, absolute greed? Hey, there's more to be made by cheap, exploitable labor, by lax environmental regulations. We can get more for us and less for them. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
This is News from the Center, WRCE. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mostly clear sky to take us through the overnight and middle 50s. By daybreak, we'll have light winds across the area. Plentiful sunshine into Friday with highs in the upper 70s, close to that 80-degree mark. Shower and thunderstorm chances heading into Saturday. Currently 65 degrees.
The Todd Alma Show.
Jane McNair, who I usually say it's lovely to hear you, Jane, but right now we have to be rivals. We have this great Civic Media Scani Summer Text to Win contest. She beat us by one texter yesterday.
We don't have anything on the line for this. Here's my suggestion. The loser has to buy the other one a steak dinner at the nicest supper club in Amory.
Okay, I'm
How
on.
About that?
I'm on.
The Todd Alma Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Wednesday, House Republicans approved a contempt resolution against Merrick Garland, our attorney general. It's the third time the chamber has pursued a contempt resolution against a sitting attorney general. This time the vote 216 to 207, no Democrats supported the resolution. One Republican actually voted against it. That's a good thing. Obviously this will end up in federal court, and I seriously doubt that they're going to prosecute Garland, but it's the message machine. This is, we're taking on that evil, you know, you've heard it. And here to share some thoughts on what this means, anything, and maybe you know how we stop this kind of craziness. I've asked our good friend, former Alabama Senator Doug Jones, to come talk with us. Doug, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of this? Obviously, the Republicans are mad at the Attorney General. I'm sure a lot of this has got to do with Trump and the belief that, you know, Joe Biden made the Manhattan District Attorney file those charges. There's a lot of craziness around our justice system right now when you look at the Republican Party right now.
Yeah, only when you look on that side. I mean, that's the only place where the craziness is going. And a lot of this, I think, Rick, is just I really do believe that this is there an effort by Republicans to deflect the fact that they now have the leader of their party having been convicted of 34 felonies and facing about 60 more. In a variety of cases, not just one Manhattan district attorney, but a special counsel in a couple of cases and a district attorney down in Georgia. And I think they're trying to deflect that. They're accusing this department of a lot of things. And I really think Merrick Garland's defense in front of the House the other day was really strong. His op-ed that appeared in the Post or the Times this week was really strong, talking about these crazy conspiracy theories. And the fact of the matter is, it was the president of the United States that invoked executive privilege. You can't really prosecute anybody as an agent when it is the principal who is exercising that authority. And it's really rich, Rick, to think that they would hold Merrick Garland in contempt for not producing the video when he produced a transcript. Everybody knows what the questions were, knows what the answers are. It's really rich when you go back over when Donald Trump was in the White House and they defied, some 100 or so subpoenas. They obstructed every which way but Sunday and really deserve more than I think Democrats gave them at the time. The only two people fully prosecuted was Bannon and Navarro, who were no longer in the White House at the time. And that's a big difference. So, and by the way, Trump never invoked executive privilege in the correct way, the way that Biden did it. There's a procedure for that. He never did it, but Democrats didn't put the point. So, I mean, it's all for show. It's all partisan politics. It's a sad state of affairs.
No, and this is the thing that bothers me. I mean, you're attacking the core fundamental fabric of what holds this country together. I mean, I listen to Republicans just go after and berate the judicial system, berate the justice system. Is it perfect? No. Does it have problems? Yeah. But when you've got 80% of Republicans who believe that, Joe Biden told Alvin Bragg, you go after him, and they buy that, I don't know where you go from there.
When you say things enough over and over and over, people then just start to believe it.
Time and repetition.
And it's you're absolutely right. The attack on our institutions of government and the hypocrisy, because they attack judiciary when things go against them, but then when they overturn the Roe versus Wade decision, they applaud it. It's and Donald Trump takes credit for that piece of the system. He takes credit for a lot of things with that. It's really the hypocrisy, and people don't see through that, and that's really sad. And I don't think, Rick, that people fully appreciate how that is eroding the fabric of democracy by attacking our judiciary like that, by attacking all institutions of government simply because you don't like a particular outcome.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite remarkable. But, when the Hunter Biden decision came down, you didn't hear the same kind of it's all rigged. You didn't hear the same kind of calls from the Republicans. They went a different direction and went after Joe Biden because clearly, Hunter Biden is a private citizen. But it was interesting to hear that they didn't want to tear down the system there.
They couldn't tear down the system there. They couldn't figure out how to do it. There was no way possible to reconcile. And, reckon it's not just the Hunter Biden case. Right now, in another court in New York that was right down the street from Donald Trump's, you got a Democratic senator going to trial under an indictment on corruption charges. So, I mean, you really can't reconcile. And I don't believe Republicans thought that Hunter Biden would get convicted because this is a case that is rarely brought. There were a lot of mitigating factors in the case. Regardless of the absolute facts and the problems for the defense in the case, there were some mitigating factors that could have either hung the jury or could have resulted in an acquittal, I believe. And I think they were waiting on that, and they would pounce on that. And when they didn't get it, they were just dumbstruck and didn't know what to say. And so they just started making up more crazy stuff about it being a diversion or a bigger problem that happened years ago. It makes no sense what people like Stephen Miller and others are saying about this.
No, I'm with you. But, I got to tell you, the president's response to it, I thought was classy. I thought it was the right thing. And it showed the compassion of a father who's dealing with a son that's had problems. And, I know a lot of people are going to identify with that. Because I said all along, I think Joe Biden is the poster child for the father that you want to have. He's not just there when times are good, but when times are tough, he's calling every day. He's checking up on you. I don't know what else to say about that guy, but I think he's an amazing father.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And you got to give a lot of credit for the First Lady, too. She was there every day. She was in trial every day. Again, you didn't have a whole bunch of, you know, mafioso types coming in like the Republicans lined up to go to the Trump trial. You had family. You had people there that cared about Hunter Biden, that was there the entire time. And the president, I thought his statement was really spot on. And I think it'll serve him well as we go into November, because it was not, Rick, just a loving father and a caring father and a supportive father for someone who has seen their son go through some very, very difficult time, very difficult time over the choices. Nobody has ever mitigated the bad choices that Hunter Biden made. But the fact of the matter is, he's pulled things around, and the president recognizes that. The First Lady recognizes that. And it is not unlike so many families in America that have had a problem like this with someone in their family, whether it is alcohol, whether it is drugs, or some other mental issue that they've had to deal with. And I think that compassion and support was palpable. And I think it's going to be one of those things that people will remember. And again, Rick, the contrast, the split image with, you didn't see Joe Biden attacking the system ever, even before the verdict. He said he was going to respect the verdict. And Donald Trump's been nothing but about Donald Trump. It's only been about him the entire time. And that's the way he's running his campaign. It's the way he's running his defenses. I think people will see that more and more as we head to November.
What's interesting to me is the juxtaposition between Trump and Hunter Biden. You know, I've got people who are, President Biden is such a victim. The system's against him, all of this stuff. And you go, well, he was convicted of 34 felonies. So he kind of did something. But Hunter Biden isn't running for anything. He's not putting himself out in the spotlight. And yet you have an entire political party who seems to want to kill this guy and make him relapse and put stress on him I see this from, if I'm the father, I'm going to be a lot more angry than Joe Biden was at the Republicans for what they're doing to push this guy potentially off the edge.
Yeah, no, I we'll see how this plays out in the coming weeks. I think, the president was coming off of Normandy, and he's headed to Italy today, for the G7 meetings. He's got a lot on his plate. That he had to deal with. He had to issue a statement. We've got a debate coming up if Trump doesn't find a way to weasel out of it. And we'll see how this plays, because I think at some point you will see a little bit more fiery Joe Biden when issues come up or questions in the media come up about how Republicans have gone after his son who had made some really bad choices.
Yeah.
A jury found that they were illegal choices, but yet has really set his life straight, and it seems to be doing very good. And I think you're going to see a different side. And I can, look, Rick, I've known this president a long time. I would imagine there's been some a little bit of fire that has been shown around in the privacy of the White House residence.
I'm sure you're right. But, the thing is that gets me, and I go back to, what we talked about a second ago, that the Republicans seem to want to tear down our institutions, the ones that they don't agree with, the ones that are actually holding them accountable. And in Trump's case, the first time in all of the years that he's been on this planet, I think this is the first time anyone's ever told him, no, you're wrong, and held him accountable. So that's pretty remarkable. But, I look at the Supreme Court where they say, well, the Supreme Court's great. I'm sure you saw the tapes this week. You heard the tapes this week of Alito being Alito. I mean, I didn't hear anything in the tape that made me go, oh, my gosh, I didn't know that. It solidified what I already believed and what he's proven over his tenure on the court. But I didn't think it was the kind of gotcha, oh, we finally got him kind of scenario. I wanted to get your thoughts on what came out of the audio tape.
Yeah, Rick, I completely agree with you. I was, in a word, kind of underwhelmed with that they've made, and that the media has made such a big deal about it. Not that it wasn't important with some of the things he said, but everybody said, he says those things in his opinions, essentially. Every time he asks a question, you can read the same thing into it. you know, I quite frankly, I don't like the whole idea of that kind of surreptitious recording. And it's something that ought to be a really nice event for the Supreme Court Historical Society, regardless of what you do. I mean, that shows a little, in my view, a little bit of a contempt for the court, and it hurts it breaks down the institution of the court when somebody violates that kind of privacy. And it's not really a fundamental right of privacy, because he was in an open thing. But you understand what I'm saying. Yeah. I didn't like it when Project Veritas did it to folks a few years ago. It's unseemly. But this was just, you know, I was pretty underwhelmed with it personally.
Yeah, I've been saying, you know, the reality is you know, we're in a digital era. And when you ran for office, what's the first thing they tell you if there's a microphone in front of you?
Yeah, watch it. Be careful what you say.
Assume it's hot. I gotta imagine if you're in a setting where people are throwing all kinds of ideological questions at you, you gotta assume there's somebody in there trying to get you. So maybe don't say we've got to return godliness to America from the Supreme Court bench. Maybe you do like Roberts did and just kind of, you know, move past it.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think people, you know, even in 2017, Rick, we had trackers. We had people coming in that were doing that. We had several that were trying to record, you know, me and others surreptitiously. They had their phones out all the time. You know, I stopped a couple of them, but I just tried to be careful. But at the same time, I was authentic. You know, the difference, though, really is a political candidate should be able to say, even in a private setting, you know, what you say in a private setting shouldn't be that much different than what you would say in a public setting about your positions and where you are. That's the nature of the political beast. A judge is supposed to be a little bit different. Judge is not, you know, shouldn't be articulating, you know, a version like that one way or another that clearly is going to show a bias on the bench for when people come there. So that's the difference a little bit. It was really unseemly that he did that. I thought the Roberts, you know, comments were really appropriate, and people ought to be really pleased with a Chief Justice that will, you know, have that kind of deference and can discipline in a setting like that to be very judicious, yeah, even in a private personal setting.
Yeah, I just wish, you know, his decisions would go that way.
Well, sure, but I mean, he's still got opinions, but at least he was not so boldly airing those opinions in a public setting that way.
No, here's the thing, and this is where, you know, I guess it's just because I'm a little bit older and I remember, you know there being, you know, respectability and you know, people, you know, wanting to get things done that help people. I look at our politics right now, Doug, and it's all about gotcha. It's all about my team winning. It's all about me getting my 15 minutes. It's all about me instead of about we. It's not about we the people. It's not about up for and by we the people of this country. It's about the ideology and the moneyed interests. And this is where I think a lot of people are frustrated, and rightly so, because this election, you couldn't have written this story, and no one would have published it. You couldn't have written a guy's running for president with 34 felonies, and they're comparing him to Jesus himself. You couldn't write that.
No, you can't do that. And, you know, and I think you're right, Rick, but at the same time, when you say, you know, people are concerned, and I totally agree with everything you just said, but if people are that concerned, they should vote that way. They should demand more of their candidates, because what ends up happening is that they say that. They say they're concerned about it. They say we need to work together. You know, everybody needs to come together. It needs to be more we than the kind of thing. But when they come down to it, they have the same views. That's what I think Donald Trump has really done, is made, has given a permission structure for even in elevators, like today when I was in an elevator, there was conversations, you know. And a great example, this lady, it was a fairly crowded elevator. This lady got on, she was in front of me. There was an elderly gentleman there that had on a veteran's hat, a Vietnam veteran's hat. And she just looked at him and she said, thank you for your service. I really appreciate it. He said, well, thank you. I looked at him. And I said, I do too. And he, and his response, instead of just letting things go, said, well, you can thank me by voting Republican. Okay. And to her credit, this one lady said, well, I'm sorry, I can't help you there. And we kind of fist bumped, but, but it is now so the politics and the team and the tribalism has so permeated everything that we do that you can't even have a conversation and compliment a veteran in the elevator for wanting, for, you know, for the lack of them wanting to just inject the politics into it. And fortunately, she was very nice and we both just kind of let it go. Some other guy chimed in, well, that's me too or something. But, you know, and I think Donald Trump has given people that permission structure out there to be very scorched earth when it comes to the politics. And also, they say one thing. And I used to say this, Rick, when I was in the Senate. I had so many people saying, you know, Senator, I didn't vote for you, but, you know, look, I wish you the best. And I just want you to, you know, to work with folks up there. And what I could really do if I ask them two more questions, it would really be, they just wanted me to do whatever Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell said.
Right.
And if you move from that at all, then you're not working with them at all.
Yeah. No. And then you're a horrible human being. And this is where, yeah, this is where the life and death part of this, where it's the other is the absolute enemy. I listen to C-SPAN radio occasionally, and it's amazing to hear the, you know, everyone's just shouting past each other. We can't have a real conversation, and that's what's frustrating. I have listeners who have, you know, sent me emails and say, I disagree with you, but you're not, you won't call. I'll call them and we'll have a conversation. And interestingly enough, I find those conversations to be helpful in that look, I want to understand what you're talking about. I want to understand why you view the world the way you do. And unfortunately, I think, as you said before, time and repetition, they've been sold the alternative facts, the alternative reality. If Trump says it, it's got to be gospel. And they buy that without having that filter that goes, that doesn't quite make sense.
No, that's right. But Rick, at the same time, I applaud you for doing those kind of things, because if we can get people, and I say it over and over, if we can engage people in more dialogues instead of monologues, we might can actually get some things done. We won't always agree, but we can get some things done, because I still believe that that at the end of the day, if we could have more of those dialogues, we could find more common ground than people might think.
No, I'm with you. Finally, I got to get your thoughts on, this is what's been bothering me. And you're a little bit older than I am, but, you know, we still remember the Cold War. I still remember, you know, 1980, the Miracle on Ice and all that stuff. I never thought I would hear Russian talking points come out of a U.S. senator's mouth, or, you know, on the floor of the House of Representatives. But, you know, I saw Tommy Tuberville, who I affectionately call the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate, from your state, say that, you know, the war in Ukraine is our fault. You know, Joe Biden did this. It's all his fault. You know, and it's not Putin's fault. I got to tell you, that doesn't sit well with me. And I'm struggling with a Republican Party that seems to be repeating a lot of the things that come out of Putin's world. Do you see the same things?
Yeah, no, I saw it. I was absolutely stunned. But I say I was stunned. He has been building up more and more like that. There is an entire Putin wing in the Republican Party right now, and it's in the Senate. He is part of it. J.D. Vance is part of it. You can go through several people. They just repeat the Vladimir Putin talking points. And it's a sad state. Can you imagine what Ronald Reagan would be saying right now if he was to see his own party doing things like that? Now, I will say this, though, Rick. That is more people in the Republican Party in the House and the Senate than I like to think should be there. But at the same time, there is still folks in that party. I had a conversation with Mitch McConnell the other day, and McConnell's going to be around for a couple more years. And this is a big issue for him. He wants to look at foreign policy. He sees that. A lot of the institutional Republicans see all this. So we'll see what happens in November, and hopefully they're going to start coming to their senses a little bit, because they are a minority within the Republican Party right now. But we'll see if that changes.
Yeah, you had 45 Republicans vote against funding the UN. So
That's been a talking point with them for a long time.
I know. Yeah. From John Bolton, we could blow it up and no one miss it. I get it. But still, it's remarkable to me. But Doug, as always, I appreciate the time. Keep up the great work. I know you're busy out there doing the good work. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again soon.
You got it, Rick. Thanks. Take care.
Our good friend Doug Jones. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Are you as concerned as I think the both of us are? I want to hear it. rick@therickssmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1914. That was the day that the Miners Union Day Parade was scheduled in Butte, Montana. In spite of the festivities, trouble was brewing down in the copper mines. Many of the miners were growing increasingly aggravated with the Butte Miners Union Local 1, part of the Western Federation of Miners. Local 1 had been established in 1893, but some thought the union was too closely affiliated with the mine owners. Wages had been stagnant for more than three decades, despite the fact that the price of copper had more than doubled during that time. Mine owners stirred the pot even more by hiring Pinkerton detectives to infiltrate the union, instructed to promote violence. The day before the parade, 1,200 miners refused to show their union cards at the Speculator Mine. This meant that they were turned away from work. The next day, the miners' parade was met with jeers and taunts. Some of the protesters chased the union officials, who were riding in the parade on horseback. The angry crowd swelled and decided to attack the union headquarters. They ripped apart the union offices and tore out the union safe. They took the safe to a field and blew off the door with dynamite, finding $1,350 inside. Alderman Frank Curran tried to disperse the crowd, but they tossed him out of the second-story window of the union's office. Fortunately, he landed in a pile of carpeting that had been ripped out by the angry mob. He escaped with a broken arm and dislocated ankle. 10 days later, an unknown assailant blew up the miners' union hall. Citing the violence they had encouraged as an excuse, the mining company declared it would no longer recognize the union. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Got to tell you, I really like Doug Jones. Smart guy, good guy. I think Alabama, bad decision. Getting rid of him and replacing him with that guy, with Tommy Tuberville, really? Wow, you can do better. You can do better. Real quick, a couple of stories caught my attention. Rudy Giuliani, evidently his lawyers are saying that he has possible 9/11 related lung disease, and I'm going, wow, pander much? Trying to keep himself not bankrupt. The former America's mayor. Now, basically crying poverty. And I got to tell you, I don't like this. It's possibly 9/11 related. I'm not buying it. Not buying it at all. My state of Pennsylvania, State Representative Stephanie Borowitz, actually thought this was part of the Borowitz report. Andy Borowitz does that comedy bit, the satire bit. Evidently, our state representative, Stephanie Borowitz, was on the House floor arguing that putting menstrual products in the bathrooms in public schools step towards communism. She says it's just another step by the governor and the Democrats to have government provide everything for you, which leads to communism. Yeah, she said that. And also, the good religious folks at the Southern Baptist Convention, the nation's largest and most powerful political Protestant organization, they voted on Wednesday to oppose IVF, the in vitro fertilization. Sorry, ladies. The religious folks said no, which is interesting because I remember a lot of my religious friends being all on board when Octomom had eight kids through IVF. And their argument at the time was, God wouldn't give her more than she could handle. Yeah, and my argument was, well, God didn't want her to have any. We figured that out. But hey, you know, maybe, who knows? Who knows with our religious folks these days? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Something I said got under your skin, on your nerves, or make you happy, made you sad. I want to hear about it. If you miss any of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.